This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
It's an honor to welcome into the studio UVA Professor Stephen Railton for a discussion that I have certainly been looking forward to about the life and the career of Nobel Prize-winning author William Faulkner, who was here in Charlottesville in the late 1950s as the University of Virginia's first writer in residence. And while he was here, he made a number of audio recordings on reel-to-reel tape, and the University of Virginia now has over 28 hours of recordings of William Faulkner in discussion, in public events, and lecturing. And we are going to hear a number of those audio clips in this hour right here on Charlottesville Right Now. Stephen, welcome to the program. I'm glad you're here.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Before we talk about William Faulkner, give us a Stephen Railton 101. You teach Faulkner and Mark Twain and a whole bunch of courses at UVA. When did you get here yourself?
Long time ago. I came in 1974, and I've been here my whole career.
And where are you from, and how did you get into...
I grew up in the Midwest, but I came here from New York, and it took a little while to get used to the differences between Charlottesville and New York City, which were a lot more striking in 1974 than they are now. But I love it here. My wife thinks she wants to go back to New England where they have real winters, but...
Yeah, we'll see how long that lasts.
I'm very happy here.
When it's still snowing in May and you're out shoveling the driveway, we'll see. So let's begin, if you can, set up for us some context. William Faulkner comes here to Virginia, to Charlottesville, to teach at the University of Virginia in 1957, right, as the first writer in residence?
Not to teach. A woman named Balch had died and left the English department at the university a great deal of money to endow somebody to come and do American literature. So they decided to use that money to fund a program for writers in residence, and that they would have a writer in residence every year. And so after a great deal of discussion, they decided to invite Faulkner to become the first writer in residence. He had already been coming to Charlottesville quite a bit. His daughter was here as the wife of a student at the University of Virginia Law School, and they'd recently had a child. So the Faulkner's first grandchild was here, too.
So that's the initial connection, then, that his daughter was married to a student.
Yes, although as a Southerner, he had always heard about the University of Virginia, and it actually shows up in some of his early novels. There's a character in Sanctuary who spends the whole novel drunk, who keeps saying that he went to a school where they taught him how to drink, and that was the University of Virginia. He was not asked about that while he was here, at least not on the record.
So who was this man who came to Virginia now as the first writer in residence in the late 1950s? And we also want to talk about UVA in the late 1950s, the school that and the community that he was coming to. But who was he by 1957?
This turned out to be very close to the end of his life. He died in 1962, and he was quite a bit older than the young man who in the 1920s had identified with writers like Joyce and Gertrude Stein and Ernest Hemingway, or painters like Picasso, who were trying to remake American literature, modern literature, to make it new, as Ezra Pound said. He'd been publishing novels for over 30 years by the time that he comes here. For most of that early career, he was being read by only a very few people. But in 1949, he was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature, and that suddenly made him a very prominent and public man. So that by the time he came here, he was both one of the world's great novelists and somebody who had an awful lot of stature and prestige.
We're talking with UVA's Stephen Railton. He is one of the scholars behind the new website, Faulkner at Virginia. It's online at faulkner.lib.virginia.edu. The University of Virginia has over 28 hours of recordings of William Faulkner when he was a writer in residence here in the late 1950s, just a few years before his death. Tell me a little bit about the moderns and what really marked the beginning of Faulkner's career. You know, you think of James Joyce, and you said Hemingway and Fitzgerald and Virginia Woolf and England and this literature doing things it had never done before in ways that it had never done before.
That's a big question, and you don't want a 50-minute lecture. Although I have lectured on that for more than 50 minutes.
Yeah. Well, and specifically how Faulkner fits into that.
Sure. Yeah, because he's from the Deep South. He grew up in a little town in Mississippi. But he had tried to get into the First World War, and he very much identified with his generation, the one that Hemingway taught everybody to call the lost generation. And they felt at the beginning of the 20th century that the old formula, either for the meaning of life or for the rules of literature, were no longer of any use to people, so that they had to make it new. That was Ezra Pound's mantra for this generation. So at the very beginning of his career, Faulkner is radically experimenting with the kinds of ways novels can tell stories, which makes those early books like The Sound and the Fury or As I Lay Dying so demanding, so difficult for most readers who are struggling with them the first time.
Yeah, and for folks who don't know As I Lay Dying, for example, like Virginia Woolf's The Waves, is just, it's the same story from different angles and different people involved in the same narrative, but they each have their own take on what's happening.
Yeah, Wallace Stevens has a wonderful poem called 13 Ways of Looking at a Blackbird, and that's all part of the same idea that the traditional novelistic idea of an omniscient narrator who can define the true story has broken down. Einstein has published his relativity theory, the idea that there is a truth that all people or even any one person can know has given way to the idea of cubism, of fragmented meaning, of discontinuousness. So that's one of the things you can see going on in Faulkner's fiction when he takes a story and kind of shatters it into all these different narrative points of view.
Yeah. And it's interesting. You see the same thing, I guess, with film, with Citizen Kane and the things that Orson Welles was doing about the same time period in film, the different points of view, the different narratives, different people telling the same story, but from a different angle.
I don't know if anybody ever asked Welles if he was influenced specifically by Faulkner, but there is obviously a deep similarity between the way Orson Welles tries to tell the story of that newspaper man, Charles Kane, and the way Faulkner tells the story of that southern plantation owner, Thomas Sutpen, in Absalom, Absalom.
Yeah. So tell me about after Faulkner sort of makes a name for himself in the 20s and really, arguably, puts southern literature on the map for the first time in a long time and starts this new generation of southern writers in the 20th century. Yeah,
actually, for most of the 20s and even well into the 30s, very few people were reading Faulkner. He was publishing prolifically and being reviewed in the little magazines and gaining more and more of a sense of recognition among the other people of his generation who were in the avant-garde. But I don't think he becomes public in the way that you're thinking of until after the Second World War.
Interesting. So he wrote for a long time, wrote and published for a long time before he achieved any notoriety, any significant notoriety.
His best-selling book from all those years was something called Sanctuary, which is a terribly sensationalist story about a rape and a lynching, and that he repudiates. You can hear him on the tapes that we have on the website apologizing for Sanctuary, which he said was basely conceived as an attempt to make some money because he'd been writing all these novels and not making any money from them.
Oh, that's great. That's really funny. It says something about the American market for literature, even then.
Oh, he's very funny when he talks about how in the little town in Mississippi where he lived in, the only books people read were the ones with a detective with a gun or a girl in her underwear on the cover. So he figured if he wanted to write a book that people would sell, it had better have a detective and a girl in her underwear.
Yeah. So William Faulkner he gets the Nobel Prize in Literature, 1940?
He gets it in 49. 1950, he goes to Stockholm and gives a speech that is still very well known, where he talks about how man will not only endure, but prevail. And then he comes back to a change sense as of internationally public figure. The State Department starts sending him around the world. And the English Department looks up and says, if we want a writer in residence, here's Mr. Faulkner. We see him walking around the Charlottesville area. He might like the job.
He's already here visiting his daughter and his grandchild. Why don't we ask him? Tell me, before we hear from Mr. Faulkner, what was the invitation unanimously endorsed here at the University of Virginia, or were there some detractors who said, no, we don't want him here?
It's hard to get the whole story straight, but we do have a number of documents in the website that make it pretty clear that the president of the University of Virginia at that time, Colgate-Darden, was very much opposed to the appointment of Faulkner. It's not clear why. He had a reputation for writing novels about things that people didn't like other people talking about. Sex, racial violence, things like that. That may have been part of it. Faulkner had been to Charlottesville once before in the early 1930s to attend a kind of a symposium of Southern writers, and apparently spent the whole time gloriously drunk. And that was well known. It was well known that he had a problem drinking, and that the last time he'd been in Charlottesville, it had been embarrassing. So that may have been why Colgate-Darden was opposed to it. But there was some resistance from the university. They didn't want him reappointed for his second term as writer in residence. But he had advocates in the English department who pushed it very strongly and prevailed.
Yeah. And while he was here, we're talking with Stephen Railton at the University of Virginia. While William Faulkner was here in the late 1950s, did he continue to drink? Was it known sort of in the community that he is a drinker? And of course, he was very active with the Hunt Club, right?
He was, yes, both those things are true. He did have to go into the hospital several different times during his two semesters as writer in residence to recover from bouts of drinking, sprees, I guess you'd call them. Although most of the time he was very faithful in fulfilling all of his quasi-contractual obligations as writer in residence, kept his office hours in Cabell Hall, showed up every place the university asked him to show up and meet these audiences and talk to them about his literature. But all that time, his real passion, besides his family, seems to have been for what was going on out at the Farmington and Keswick Hunt Clubs. And we have a number of pictures of him, which always take my breath away, in full hunting regalia, sitting astride those big horses. You know, I have no way to connect with that culture. And so to me, I picture him writing a great book. But by that point in his life, he seems to have gotten the most pleasure out of riding a big horse.
We're talking with Stephen Railton, the University of Virginia. Before we take a quick break here, let's hear from Mr. Faulkner himself, and specifically addressing a question about violence in modern novels, which, as you point out, he was sort of known for. That reputation preceded him, and a lot of people were taking note of the fact that a lot of the new literature included more violence than people had been previously been used to. Do you want to set this up for us?
Well, only because he's not going to say very much about violence. He had a habit of turning these questions, which were often asking him to talk about things he didn't want to talk about. What do you mean by this symbol in your work, for example? He had a habit of turning those questions in his direction, and he ends up, in this particular case, giving a wonderful answer about how man, by which he means mankind, the human race, will prevail.
William Faulkner at the University of Virginia in the late 1950s.
The dramatic story is man is faced a frail, fragile creature of flesh and bone, mostly water, in a ramshackle universe stuck together with electricity, faced with problems which are usually bigger than he is. The story is, does he face it, does it lick him, or does he beat it, or if it licks him, or does he get beaten to his knees still, as Hemingway says, looking good. That, I think, is what anyone writes about. It's man that is striving to be braver than he might be, more honest than he might be, to be compassionate.
William Faulkner at the University of Virginia. We are joined live in studio with UVA's Stephen Railton. A new website recently launched, Faulkner at Virginia, with hours of audio clips of William Faulkner. It's faulkner.lib.virginia.edu. So he takes that question of violence in literature and basically says, this is the human condition. Man is struggling. Human beings are always fighting to overcome and to find meaning in their lives.
And he's not convinced that they will win the fight, but just that they will continue to fight it.
Interesting. So let's hear, we have time for some more before we break for news here at the bottom of the hour. What is Yakna Batafa? And put that in context for us, because he answers a question about that as well.
I'm not sure what clip this is, but Yakna Batafa is the name that he gave, what he called in another place, his postage stamp of native soil, that portion of Northeast Mississippi in which most of his great fiction takes place. The original of Yaknapatawpha is obviously Lafayette County, which is where Oxford and the University of Mississippi and Faulkner's childhood all were. But in his fiction, he transforms it into Yaknapatawpha. And most of his books cycle back through the families of Yaknapatawpha, Sardaris, Compson, Sutpen, Snopes. He makes it his own world, like Middle Earth, sort of like Tolkien in Middle Earth.
Yeah. Here he is answering a question about how to pronounce it.
If you break it down into syllables, it's simple, Yoknapatawpha, Yaknapatawpha. It's a Chickasaw Indian word meaning water runs slow through flatland.
Let's rejoin our conversation with UVA's Stephen Railton, the scholar behind the new website, William Faulkner at Virginia. The website is faulkner.lib or L-I-B dot virginia.edu. And Stephen, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, can I explain what the L-I-B stands for?
Yes, please.
That's just short for library, and that none of this is possible without the extraordinary help and work of all kinds of people at the UVA library. They're the ones who archived these magnetic tapes. They have provided an awful lot of support to building the website. So that's the LIB is just short for library.
Yeah. Faulkner.lib.virginia.edu. We're talking about William Faulkner, the first writer in residence at the University of Virginia in 1957 and 58, just a few years before he died. The website archives hours of recordings of William Faulkner here at the University of Virginia, and we are going to listen to more of those recordings and give some context. Let's go right to an answer he gave to a question during a public event where he was asked about the symbols in his novels. Was this just something teachers, professors of English were teaching at the time, exploring the symbolism of Faulkner?
That's probably the most frequently asked kind of question that he gets in these 30-something public sessions that he did. His fiction, as you know, is very difficult for most readers. And so they thought they could save the trouble of trying to figure out what they thought it meant by asking Mr. Faulkner, why are the spotted horses spotted? What does the snake mean in the bear? In this particular case, Joseph Plotner, who was the UVA professor who had a lot to do with bringing him here and who's actually running the tape recorder most of the time, and who then some years after Faulkner leaves UVA starts writing the biography of Faulkner that is still considered the definitive one. Blotner asks him about a novel called Pylon and whether the pylon in the novel isn't a symbol for the central female character around whom all these men fly.
Now there's some more of this erudite professorial symbolism gets into it. I'm sure that you're quite right. I just hadn't thought of that. I'm glad to know it. I remember that. I'll use that sometime, Paul.
That's one of my favorite answers, although that's the funniest example of the way in which he refuses very politely to answer that kind of question, to sort of keep the reader from having to think through these things for herself or himself.
He refused to be academic about his own writing. Is that right? I mean, he just he was respectful, but he didn't want to go down that road.
And by this point in his career, he's almost in full flight from the idea that he is the great modernist artist, so that he describes himself most of the time as a carpenter, so that as a writer, he's always reaching for a tool. He's trying to turn the corner of the chicken coop that he's building. Very folksy.
Yeah. I was telling you during the break, I love Southern literature, and my fiction tends in that direction. But I've never been able to really embrace Faulkner as much as I have tremendous respect for his place in history, his significance as a Southern writer, especially with the moderns and what he was doing, which was so new and so fresh. But in terms of just story and being able to sit with a book, I struggle with that as I would with Thomas Wolfe. And a lot of it has to do with the long sentences and the really, and maybe it's just my postmodern 21st century mind that has trouble with such what I see as almost overburdening detail on in some places. And I'm sure you must hear this all the time. Oh, William Faulkner again. I've never been able to get through a Faulkner novel.
And it is one reason why students want to take a course in him, because the name itself conjures up greatness, but their own experience with reading Faulkner tends to be so frustrating, so that they're looking for help.
And what's your advice?
You can take my course, and I will see how far we can get you into Faulkner. I don't think he's necessarily the greatest 20th century American writer, and I think there is a price that he ended up paying for the incredible difficulty of many of his novels. I think he came more and more to feel as if there was something lost when the writer makes it so difficult for most people to appreciate the stories that he's telling. I think that's one reason why he was so happy to be here and willing to stand up in front of all these audiences and talk about his work. In the 20s, I don't think there would have been a chance of that. He would have been more likely to want to sit at a cafe table in Paris with James Joyce and talk about art. But by this point in his career, you can hear him trying to reach out to a larger public.
Yeah.
Keep trying him. He's worth it.
Now, here is his response when asked about the long sentences in his writing.
I think that probably goes back to the burden which man carries all his life, is the knowledge of death. That is, he knows that he won't live forever, and he's found something so amazing and so moving, which is breathing or being in the world, a part of it. And in a way, he is attempting to write the whole history of the human heart on the head of a pen, because he thinks he may not last long enough to put it down on anything as big as a piece of paper. Also, I think that a man and any moment of action is the living sum of his past. The reason for the long sentences that go so far into the past and into the future is that belief that man, at the very moment in which he is doing something, he did that particular thing exactly in that way because of the 100 years before him that made it. And that's simply a matter of trying to remind the reader that this man is complete in motion only because he is the sum of his ancestors and his condition, his times.
Wow.
Don't you like the way that somebody asks him why you write long sentences and he answers them with a very long sentence?
But it really is an interesting perspective. And he didn't try to do a jujitsu trick here and avoid the answer or avoid the question. He really tried to substantially deal with this question, because I'm sure he had gotten it before.
Yes. And I think in particular, the second part of that answer where he talks about attempting to represent a reality in which the moment in which people are acting is saturated by this past that is always there and always deeply shaping their behavior. That was central to his way of understanding human action, individual identities, the larger human experience. At times, those long sentences can seem simply like a mannerism, and at times I think they are. But at other times, when you're reading Absalom, Absalom, and drowning in these long sentences, well, that's because the story that he's telling is how the culture of the South that he's writing about simply remains unable to escape its past.
Interesting. Yeah. And there's his famous line, "The past is not dead. In fact, it's not even past." That speaks exactly to what you're talking about. When he started writing in the 20s, when he's a young man growing up, and there's, you know, the old men are Civil War veterans, and they're still talking about the glory of the South and the lost cause.
I grew up in Illinois, and as you can tell, I don't have really the right accent to be talking about Faulkner at all. And growing up in Illinois, we were free of a past. We had no sense of a past at all. So I look on with a kind of awe at someone like Faulkner, who knew from the time he was very young that there was all this history that was constantly casting its shadow over the world that he lived in.
Yeah. And as he writes, as he talks in that clip, that truly, as he reads it at least, informs our actions today, that that past is still there in the present moment.
And Obama, of course, quoted that line when he had to give the speech during the presidential campaign in 2008. He had to address the question of race because of Reverend Wright's sermons having hit the internet and the blogs and so on. And the point that Obama was using Faulkner to make was how we may not want to talk about race anymore, and we may think that with all these changes in the law, we have left the racism of America's past entirely behind, but the past is never dead.
We're talking with UVA Stephen Railton about the life and the career of Nobel Prize-winning author William Faulkner, who was here in Charlottesville at the University of Virginia in the late 1950s before he passed away in July of 1962. Stephen, let's hear a clip. We're talking about the South now. Let's hear a clip, William Faulkner talking about the curse on the South. Set this up for us.
Well, there are two ways to set it up. One is through Faulkner's fiction and the way that from the beginning, at least from the first Yakna Potofa novel, which was called Sardaris when it was published and is now published as Flags in the Dust, from the beginning there has been that sense that haunts the characters in his novels that something has already happened, in this case the Civil War, slavery, the loss of the Civil War, that has permanently transformed whatever future might be available to them. So there's that, but then there's also the immediate context of the late 1950s and coming from Mississippi to Virginia at a time when the South is under enormous pressure to change its racial status quo. He's often asked in these sessions to talk about the Supreme Court decision. And in 1957, nobody has to say which Supreme Court decision is meant. It's Brown versus Board of Education, which was decided just 3 years before he came here, which told the South that it could no longer segregate the public school system, so that by the time he gets here, there have already been a number of very sharp clashes between people who don't want change and the government insisting that all white schools have to be integrated. So that's the other part of the background when he's answering this question about the curse that's on the South.
Yes, sir.
Throughout your work, there seems to be a theme that there's a curse upon the Southern. I was wondering if you could explain what this curse is and if there's any chance for the Southern to escape it.
The curse is slavery, which is an intolerable condition. No man shall be enslaved. And the South has got to work that curse out, and it will, if it's let alone. It can't be compelled to do it. It must do it of its own will and the desire, which I believe it will do, if it's let alone.
So it sounds like he would not or did not endorse federal efforts out of Washington to integrate the South.
He was very critical of the Southern status quo, and in his fiction, he comes more and more directly to wrestle with the moral problem of race and racism and the way that it has blighted so much in the South that— like Quentin Compson and Absalom Absalom, he loves and hates at the same time. So as a Southern writer writing about the South, he can be very critical. But as a Southerner addressing the larger country, he's very defensive and insistent that the South needs to solve this problem. Now, unfortunately, like many of my students still, when Faulkner says the South, he tends simply, unconsciously, to mean the white South. You say the South and you don't see the fact that, you know, half the South has always been black. So to our ears, he can sound very reactionary when he talks like that, that the South must be left alone to work this out. And he will sometimes say it will take decades to work this out, as if in the meantime, black lives weren't being stunted and deprived and treated unjustly. In the time, however, and this is one of the things we try to do in the site, we try to help people appreciate the cultural and historical context of the times. in the time that he was saying these things about race and integration, Faulkner was becoming more and more of a pariah in Mississippi because he was willing to challenge the racial status quo. And that's another reason why he was, I think another reason why he was interested in coming to Charlottesville. He was hoping to find here, I think, a slightly more liberal, not using that word as a political term,
open-minded, progressive.
Open-minded, yeah. That's a much better word. Yeah. Well, even progressive has now become
a political term.
But let's say open-minded, which is not quite what he actually found here when it came to the question of integration.
Yeah, I was going to say, when he's here in the late 50s is the era of massive resistance, and the governor orders the schools closed in Charlottesville, and even the white students aren't able to go to the schools.
At the beginning of his second semester as writer-in-residence, the spring term 1958, he decided on his own to make his first public event the reading of a speech called A Word to Virginians, in which he asks Virginia. This is after things like a bombing in Clinton and the federal troops being called in to Little Rock. He asks Virginia to show the rest of the South the way forward from this past of slavery and racism and segregation into a some more civilized future. And he says it's up to Virginia to do that because the rest of the South has so much respect for Virginia as the mother of the South and as the cultural leader of the South. But then in the responses that speech got in the audience, if you play the whole tape, it's really interesting to hear, the people aren't interested in sort of leading the South out of integration, I mean, out of segregation. And as you say, in fact, what happened immediately after he left in the fall of 1958, they did decide to close all the public schools in Charlottesville.
Yeah, and it wasn't until a few years later. We've had UVA Professor Emeritus Paul Gaston on the program talking about his efforts. And those many people in the community, not just Paul Gaston, but when he was beaten in the street down in front of Buddy Glover's restaurant on Emmett Street, that sort of turned the tide, specifically because business owners in Charlottesville didn't want to look like Mississippi. So they called Paul and said, "We're integrating now. We don't want to look like." So in a sense, they were sort of forced to become leaders and set an example.
I guess so, yeah.
We're talking about William Faulkner and Virginia. Let's play this clip where he talks about Virginians and snobs.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Have you enjoyed your stay here at the university?
Yes, sir, very much.
We were interested in your comment of coming to Virginia because you like snobs. I wonder if you like
Well, I thought that we were more or less informal then, and I didn't really mean that as a serious observation. But let me define what I mean by a snob is someone who is so complete in himself and so satisfied with what he has that he needs nothing from anybody. That when a stranger comes up, he can accept that stranger on the stranger's turn, provided only the stranger observe a few amenities of civilization. And to me, that's what people, what Virginians do. They never push at me. They want nothing of me. They will offer me their hospitality, and they will accept me. All I have to do is just behave decently.
What are your thoughts on that clip?
That goes back to the first day that he was on the grounds in February 1957, and somebody at a news conference asked him, why are you here? What do you like about Virginia? And he said, I've always liked Virginians because they are snobs. And that aroused a lot of controversy in the local press at the time. So he's still explaining what he means. He didn't mean it as an insult because he said snobs are people who don't have to bother other people. They're willing to let people alone.
Yeah, and he appreciated that.
He wanted very much to be left alone most of the time.
We're joined by UVA's Stephen Railton. The website, the new William Faulkner Archive, online archive of audio recordings of William Faulkner at Virginia, is Faulkner.lib, short for library, faulkner.lib.virginia.edu, or you can just Google Faulkner at Virginia and you'll find the website. Let's play this clip about James Joyce. Can you set this up for us?
Well, Joyce, of course, had an enormous influence, not just on Faulkner, but on all the avant-garde writers of that generation. I think the evidence is pretty clear that one reason why Faulkner, after the First World War, and with very little money, paid his way to Paris for a short visit. He just wanted to see Joyce. It was kind of a pilgrimage. So he's asked questions about a number of writers during these sessions at the University of Virginia. And this is his answer to a question about James Joyce.
Yes, ma'am.
Can I ask what you think of James Joyce?
James Joyce was one of the great men of my time. He was electrocuted by the divine fire. He, Thomas Mann, were the great writers of my time. He was probably, might have been the greatest, but he was electrocuted. He had more talent than he could control.
Wow, what a line. Electrocuted by the divine fire. Is that what he says?
That's what he says. He's thinking of the way that Joyce made his own work more and more inaccessible as his career went on. So that you go from Dubliners to the portrait of a Portrait of the Artist to Ulysses and finally to Finnegan's Wake.
Which is unreadable.
Which for most people is unreadable. If you look at Faulkner's career, it does tend to go in the opposite direction from being very inaccessible to making a deliberate attempt to reach a wider and wider audience.
And was that a conscious effort on his part to try to sort of rein in what his artistry perhaps wanted to do?
I wouldn't want to speak for him. That's the way I read it. I'll put it that way, that I think at some point he realized that it was impoverishing his art and that art itself would be impoverished if it tried to become too inaccessible to almost every reader but the most elite and sophisticated ones.
Yeah. We've got time for just one more clip here. It's an answer to a question about Christianity. We'll hear it and then get your response.
Why? The Christian religion has never harmed me. I hope I never have harmed I have the sort of provincial Christian background which one takes for granted without thinking too much about it, probably. That I'm probably within my own lights, I feel that I'm a good Christian. Whether that would please anybody else's standard or not, I don't know.
Was he a very religious man?
Religious. One of the great questions that his work wrestles with is the question of meaning. What does it mean? Why are we here? Is there a meaning? Organized religion, institutional religion, is typically treated very critically in his work. And the reason why the audience laughs a little bit nervously when he responds the way that he did is because for a number of people, he was godless as well as rude in the kinds of things that he wrote about. Was he religious? He does wrestle with the big question. So,
what was his answer in his novel to that question, though?
The question
the,
of meaning.
The meaning, yeah. What was his answer?
It changes. It's not always the same. I think at the beginning, like a lot of the early 20th century writers, life itself seems almost completely without meaning, so that you have to turn to art. Art can construct or create meaning, but only in art will you find order and meaning.
That kind of meaning that satisfies for those for whom organized religion does not.
But then, if you read something like The Bear, which is about that boy Ike McCaslin going into the big woods and having that, it's not a religious encounter, but it's certainly a spiritual one with the bear itself and something like the spirit of nature or of the wilderness, he did seem to keep looking for meaning and not to be content simply to say, well, we can make it in art, but we won't ever find it anyplace else.
The website is faulkner.lib.virginia.edu. You can Google the Faulkner at Virginia online audio archive. Thanks to scholar Stephen Railton, who teaches William Faulkner at the University of Virginia. It has been a great thrill and a real honor to have you here. I really appreciate it.
Well, no, thank you, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit cvillepodcast.com for more.